content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kippen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue reading from the September 2021 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. We'll begin with an article titled Seeds of Conflict by Joshua Hammer. Turkish authorities and British archaeologists are battling over ancient plants that are essential to science and might hold clues to new superfoods. On a sultry morning in September 2020, a team of Turkish officials showed up unannounced at the British Institute at Ankara, tucked on two floors of a five-story office building down the hill from the embassy district. For seven decades, the institute has overseen some of the most important archaeological work in Turkey, including the discovery of one of the world's first proto-cities, Çatalhöyük, a 9,000-year-old Neolithic settlement on the Anatolian plain. Institute archaeologists have documented the transition from hunting and gathering to farming, a breakthrough that Logan Kistler, an ancient plant geneticist at the Smithsonian Institution, calls the most important process in the history of humanity. Despite decades of cordial cooperation between the researchers and the Turkish government, the institute has recently come under attack by the authoritarian regime of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. A pointed threat arose in 2019 when a government statute suddenly declared all seeds and plants collected by foreign organizations to be the property of Turkey. That jeopardized the institute's unique collection of ancient grains gathered decades ago from Anatolian sites. These charred organic materials have mainly been of interest to paleobotany scholars, who trickle into the institute to compare them with modern strains, and thus better understand early varieties of wheat, rye, and other domesticated grains. But Ibrahim Sarıkoğlu, a Turkish TV personality, an Austrian-educated chemist who has earned legions of fans by promoting broccoli as a cure for prostatitis, among other questionable treatments, argues that the ancient seeds are not only critical to the nation's history, but also have enormous medicinal and agricultural potential. Sarıkoğlu is the chief advisor to Turkey's Ancestral Seed Project, founded by First Lady Emine Erdogan, which promises to revolutionize agriculture by, in Erdogan's words, reviving seeds from the most ancient geography in the world. The long-defunct crops of their Neolithic ancestors, Erdogan and Sarıkoğlu suggest, contain a roadmap to creating a new generation of superfoods, nutritious and disease and drought-resistant grains that might reduce famine and help people live longer, healthier lives. Revive the ancestral seeds that are about to be lost, the First Lady recently urged. Sarıkoğlu was among the officials who barged into the British Institute's offices, where a couple of dozen Turkish and British staff members spend their days supervising archaeological digs, as well as overseeing cultural programs that celebrate Turkey's ancient past, including a walking trail that cuts across the Taurus Mountains in west-central Anatolia. The officials informed the director, a low-key Belgian archaeologist named Lugard Vandeput, that they were taking possession of the Hillman seed collection, named after an Englishman who began his collecting in Turkey in 1969. Vandeput objected. By a long-standing agreement with Turkey's Ministry of Culture and Tourism, she pointed out, the institute served as the collection's custodian. Perhaps they could agree to share the resource. Would they settle for one-third? One-half? The Turks left the institute without reaching an agreement. 3 days later, however, they returned. This time, as Vandeput watched in dismay, they removed 108 boxes of archaeological specimens and four cupboards comprising the modern seed collection, loaded them into vans, and drove away. The raid on the British Institute shook the world of archaeology. Some Western scientists and their allies called it a display of nationalistic muscle flexing designed to enhance Erdogan's popularity, much like the July 2020 presidential decree that made Hagia Sophia, the Byzantine cathedral-turned-museum in Istanbul, a mosque. And indeed, many Turks applauded the seizure, seeing it as a victory in the battle for the proprietary rights to a country's heritage. "We took it back from the English," declared the headline in the newspaper Haber. Seeds and plants are state property, and as important as an underground sarcophagus or an inscription, opined the Daily Oneido. Turkey's tightly controlled press rushed to interview Çağatay, who whipped up resentments against the British by accusing them of plundering Turkey's heritage. "Is Austria authorized to collect plants in Switzerland or Germany? Britain should know that it cannot collect every plant that comes to it. They do not have the permission." He ridiculed the British Institute's attempts to compromise. "They say, let's share one third, but we do not divide," he declared in a TV interview. "This is the property of the great Turkish nation. These are priceless seeds. Do you think you read stupid on the foreheads?" The raid was a dramatic turning point in a love-hate relationship that existed between the Turkish government and British archaeologists since the early 1950s, when a young Englishman named James Millart arrived in Turkey and put the country on the archaeological map. A graduate in Egyptology from University College London, Millart dreamed of digging up an ancient city that would make him as famous as Heinrich Schliemann, the German businessman archaeologist who had unearthed Troy in the 1870s. Pursuing a hunch that civilization had begun not only in the Levant and the Fertile Crescent, but also in Anatolia, Millart, in November 1958, targeted a huge mound on the Konya Plain and soon excavated 150 rooms and buildings, many of them decorated with murals, reliefs, and sculptures. Spread out over 32.5 acres, Çağatay was determined to have a peak population of about 8,000. It was one of the earliest human settlements ever uncovered. It provided a window into pre-Bronze Age religion and art, and the epochal transition from a nomadic to a sedentary lifestyle. This was huge, and what it did was give Turkey a past, which went back further than anybody had imagined before, says Stephen Mitchell, the Berlin-based chairman of the British Institute at Ankara, which sponsored Millart's excavations. Then came Millart's downfall. In 1958, just as the Çağatay discovery was making headlines, the archaeologist announced an equally spectacular find. During a train ride taken from Istanbul to Izmir, he had noticed that a young woman sitting across from him was wearing a striking gold armband. She invited him back to her home in Izmir, Millart claimed, where she permitted him to sketch, but not photograph, an array of treasures, including ceremonial axes, marble figurines, and gold ornaments. Millart said she told him that the artifacts had been looted from the tombs of a long-vanished sea people near the city of Dorak, south of the Sea of Marmara. Millart's article about the find, published in the Illustrated News of London, and accompanied by his drawings, caused a sensation. But he couldn't back up his fantastic tale with photos. Millart always insisted that he'd been truthful, but many colleagues are convinced that the attention-seeking archaeologist had manufactured the entire episode. The Turkish press, on the other hand, accused him of stealing the country's patrimony and smuggling the cache of precious artifacts to England for a take that they claimed was in the tens of millions of dollars. Turkish government banned Millart from working in the country, and in 1964 shut down Çağatay for a generation. The reputation of the British Institute was badly tarnished. Millart was a fantastically lucky archaeologist, Mitchell says, but he was also a fantasist. He made stuff up. And though the fraud scandal is decades old, it's a fact of life if you work in Turkey. For all his deceit and disgrace, Millart made discoveries that led to an explosion of archaeological interest in the region and gave a lift to the emerging science of paleobotany. once obscure area of research this discipline has taken on more importance as archaeology has become more holistic, analyzing not just physical artifacts, but also attempting to encompass a wider range of ancient human experience, including diet, domestication of animals, use of medicinal plants, fire building, and so on. Paleobotanists have enriched understanding of Greco-Roman society by revealing that ancient Neapolitan seafarers brought aboard their galleys dried fruits, walnuts, and chestnuts, valued for their imperishability and high energy content. DNA research on 2.5 million-year-old peach stones in China suggests the fruit was a favorite of early Asian hominids and evolved through natural selection before being domesticated. In 1969, Gordon Hillman, a seed merchant's son from Sussex, England, who studied agricultural botany at Reading University and archaeobotany in Mainz, Germany, went to Turkey under the institute's auspices. He joined an excavation project at Asvan, a village that was about to be swallowed up by a hydroelectric dam. Hillman sifted through ancient hearths using river water to separate carbonized seeds from archaeological sediments. He also spent months with local farmers, observing their age-old planting and harvesting techniques. Hillman came up with new theories about how Neolithic man foraged ancient wild wheat, barley, and other grains, and eventually learned to domesticate their wild strains. The grains changed over time as they adapted to the uses and environments people subjected them to, developing tougher husks, for example, to make them suitable for threshing. He gave his life to the field, and much of his work has withstood the test of time, says Ian Hoder, who succeeded Mellart as chief archaeologist at Catalhoyuk in the 1990s. Hillman became best known for his seed collection, which allowed two generations of scholars to gain insight into ancient farming. Between 1969 and 1975, Hillman gathered carbonized grains at the Neolithic settlements of Asvan and Khan Hassan, and also retrieved modern seeds, both wild and domesticated, in surrounding villages in the countryside. He picked up samples in fragile environments that no longer exist, plucking wild emmer and einkorn wheat, for example, in a region of lakes, swamps, and meadows in the southeast Konya Plain that have since dried up and disappeared. The vast variety of seeds he gathered presented a near-complete picture of ancient diets in Anatolia. He also contained, in the minds of some Turkish scientists at least, the promise of a food revolution. The Turks carried the Hillman collection to vaults in two museums in Ankara, where presumably they will soon be turned over to the Ancestral Seed Project. No scholar I spoke with knows what will happen to the specimens. Speeches by Erdogan and Çalhanoğlu suggest that scientists will try to regenerate the ancient seeds in an effort to extract information, though those were burned thousands of years ago. The thinking is that the ancient grains might be more healthful than modern ones, perhaps containing less gluten and other hard-to-digest protein. Moreover, the Turkish officials believe the ancient seeds might harbor genes for traits that have been lost to modern agribusiness and its monocultures and cloned crops. Agronomy that focuses on favoring certain traits has produced higher yields, to be sure, but it has also made crops more vulnerable to diseases. In the 1840s, Europeans brought back a few varieties of potatoes from the Americas and based a huge part of their food economy on the tubers. Then a fungal-like parasite came along and started rotting the roots. The entire crop was destroyed, and the Irish potato famine was the result. A deadly fungus that has decimated banana plantations in Southeast Asia for 30 years recently migrated to Latin America, the heart of the banana export market. A single strain of the fruit, known as the Cavendish banana, which can be shipped long distances and stay green, accounts for 2/3 of global exports and has proven to be defenseless against the rot. Farmers have bred shorter wheat plants with more grains and less chaff so they can be easily threshed by a machine, but this has significantly reduced wheat varieties and made the staple vulnerable as well. Yet scientists have serious doubts about the Turkish officials' hopes of reviving the Neolithic era seed material. The ancient seeds are shriveled, carbonized bits of black stuff. They're not going to send up green shoots, Mitchell says. It sounds like Steven Spielberg to me. That's not to say that reviving ancient seeds is an impossible dream. plant geneticists have roamed the globe in recent years, bringing back to their laboratories 5,000-year-old maize from a cave in Mexico, ancient sorghum from Nubia in southern Egypt, and Bronze Age rice from the western province of Xinjiang in China. Unlike the charred, lifeless lumps in the Hillman collection, these antique strains, saved from decay by desiccated conditions, often bear intact genomes and stand a good chance of being revived. 13 years ago, Israeli scientists succeeded in germinating the 1,900-year-old seed of a Judean date palm, Phoenix dactylifera, one of the earliest domesticated fruit crops praised by the ancients for its sweet taste and medicinal properties, from Herod's great palace overlooking the Dead Sea. The palm seed's germplasm, its living tissue that can breed new life, had survived 2 millennia in the Negev desert. It became reanimated after treatment in a fertilizer and hormone-rich solution. The seed produced a male date palm known as the Methuselah tree, which is making pollen and has grown today to a height of more than 11 feet. Some scientists believe that there may be ways to extract usable DNA from the carbonized matter in which the germplasms died long ago. Using genomic sequencing and gene editing tools like CRISPR, the technology used in developing COVID-19 vaccines, researchers have begun to insert fragments of genetic information into seeds to create new types. Scientists recently used gene therapy to create a domesticated version of the ground cherry, Physalis pruniosa, a tasty yellow berry that grows in the wild. The wild cherries drop to the ground and scatter their seeds in order to ensure survival of the species. Using CRISPR, scientists introduced genes from the tomato, a relative of the ground cherry, to create more compact plants and larger fruits that hang on vines rather than drop to the ground as they ripen, making them easy to harvest. Replicating the process using gene fragments extracted from carbonized chunks will be harder, but perhaps not impossible. We can sequence in the gene just like we can sequence a woolly mammoth, but it doesn't mean we can remake the ancient maize, says Kistler. Hillman's collection also contained live recent seeds, also potentially useful to Turkish plant geneticists. Most were land races, traditional crops grown in isolation over the centuries, collected from Anatolian farmers. Saving the lineages of extant land races for their variety is an incredibly important component of maintaining biodiversity, says Kistler. The prospect of creating new plant types excites Sarah Koglu of the Ancestral Seed Project. If your ancestor seed is the Canakale tomato, you can cross it with Achilles tomato and create a whole new variety, he said in a recent interview. If you're lucky, maybe it'll be a very high quality. In the future, hunger will envelop the world. There is no escape. Creating entirely new varieties of crops, he adds, is such a bonus. You can't measure its value in dollars. Back to the British Institute at Ankara. The shell-shocked staff continues to deal with the fallout from the government seizure. To be sure, some Turks rushed to the Institute's defense. Aylin Onitan, a Turkish journalist and plant expert based in Istanbul, was shocked by the aggressive tactics and belligerent tone displayed by Sarah Koglu and his team. The way it was done was rude. They could have been more smooth and diplomatic, she says. Many Turkish scholars and scientists, she says, were outraged. By two rounds of media attacks in late 2020, apparently orchestrated by Sarah Koglu, have put researchers on edge, leaving them to worry that the government might shut down the entire institution. The newspaper Haber quoted Sarah Koglu's diatribes at length. They didn't want to give it, the seeds, to us at first, but we said, look, you are breaking the law, and we finally got them. The situation is unpredictable and difficult to live with, says Van de Put. Mitchell, monitoring the episode from his home in Berlin, says that Turkey's power play was bound to happen at some point. When I first went to Turkey, it was a tiny speck in the world. Now it's a middle-sized word, power, with all of that consequent, Mitchell says. Our relationship has changed. Likewise, Hodder says Turkey is responding to the historic tendency of British and American archaeology authorities to treat the Middle East as a playground to discover our origins. And I do feel culpable in that sense. I feel that that's a negative. He describes the West attitude as a form of Orientalism, using a term popularized by the late Arab-American academic Edward Said that connotates paternalism and exploitation. So was the confiscation justified? It's true that the seizure, carried out with little warning, was clumsy and bullying, but it also reflects a growing push around the globe for reclaiming cultural patrimony. The Turkish move was not so different from the efforts made by Peru, Egypt, and other nations to bring back cultural artifacts seized by 19th and 20th century European and American archaeologists and adventurers. It just takes that clash into a new arena and gives it a 21st century spin. There's also the question of the scientific value of the seed bank. Sarah Kolgu has a reputation for medical quackery, and his hope to breathe new life into dead material seems to verge on Dr. Frankenstein's pseudoscience. The raid on the Institute and Sarah Kolgu's pronouncements afterwards smacked of resentment and political one-upmanship. But the goals espoused by him and Turkey's First Lady, creating more nutritious foods and eliminating hunger, are worthy ones. And it may well be that an aggressive effort to exploit the British collection could work toward that. To date, however, the Turks have shown no signs of building a lab to regenerate the seeds, and Sarah Koglu's comments sound more like gloating than scientific seriousness. For now, says Van de Put, the only possible strategy is to hunker down and hope to survive the barrage of negative attention. Today, the atmosphere is even more sensitive than in a porcelain shop, she says. Our feeling of security is completely gone. Next, we'll go to prologue, Decoding Lady Wrath, by V.M. Braganza in the literature section. On the trail of the first female English novelist, a Renaissance noblewoman with a secret she hinted at in a cipher. Two summers ago, I found myself face to face with a 400-year-old mystery. I was trying to escape the maze of books at first, London's rare book fair in Battersea Park. The fair was a tangle of stalls overflowing with treasures gleaming in old leather, paper, and gold. Then as I rounded a corner, a book stopped me. I felt as though I'd seen a ghost, and in a sense, I had. Stamped on its cover was an intricate monograph that I recognized instantly. It identified the book as the property of Lady Mary Wrath. She was a pathbreaker, a contemporary of Shakespeare in the early 17th century. Wrath was England's first female writer of fiction. The startling thing about seeing this book was that her house in England burned down two centuries ago, and her extensive library with it. Not one book was believed to exist. As a literary scholar specializing in rare books, I had seen a photograph of the monogram 5 years earlier on the bound leather manuscript of a play Wrath had written that was not in the library at the time of the fire. Now it appeared that the volume I was staring at, biography of the Persian Emperor Cyrus the Great, had escaped the inferno as well. The monogram was not merely a few fancy initials, although fashionable nobles of Wrath's period were known to adorn their books, jewelry, and portraits with elaborate designs. This was more, a coded symbol, a cipher. It was unmistakable to me. Ciphers can see meanings in plain sight and require the viewer to possess some secret knowledge or key to understand their meaning, one with which the creator wants only a few to know. To most people, Wrath's cipher would look like a pretty decoration. Little known today, Wrath was notorious in her time. A noblewoman in the court of King James I, Wrath was a published author at the time when the culture demanded a woman's silence and subservience. Queen Elizabeth's master of the revels, Edmund Tilney, went so far as to say in 1568 that a husband should steal away his wife's private will. But an author she was. In 1621, Wrath's first and only printed work caused a scandal. A romance entitled The Countess of Montgomery's Urania, often simply called The Urania, is the forerunner of modern novels. At nearly 600 pages, it contains more characters than War and Peace or Middlemarch, and is based largely on Wrath's own family and acquaintances at court, some of whom were outraged to find their lives and exploits published under a veil of fiction. One aristocrat wrote a scathing invective about the impropriety of Wrath's work. She fired back, calling him a drunken poet who penned vile, railing, and scandalous things, and brazenly challenged him to aver it to my face. Later women novelists, such as Jane Austen, Charlotte Bronte, and George Eliot, owed a historical debt to Mary Wrath's 17th century struggle to be heard. Perhaps the defining point of Wrath's life was when she fell in love with a man who was not her husband. He was William Herbert, the dashing 3rd Earl of Pembroke. Herbert had a reputation as a patron of the arts and in something of a cad. In 1609, Shakespeare dedicated his sonnets to W.H., and scholars still speculate that William Herbert was the beautiful young man to whom the first 126 love sonnets were addressed. Though we don't know whether Roth and Herbert's romance began before or after her husband's death in 1614, it continued into the early 1620s and lasted at least a few years, producing two children, Catherine and William. Roth modeled their Urania's main characters, a pair of lovers named Pamphilia and Amphilantus, after herself and Herbert. On the Urania, Pamphilia writes love poems and gives them to Amphilantus. In real life, Roth wrote a romantic play titled Love's Victory and gave a handwritten manuscript of it to Herbert. The volume, bound in fine leather, is the only other known to be marked with her cipher. Designed with the aid of a bookbinder, or perhaps by Roth alone, the cipher must have been intended to remind Herbert of their love, for the jumbled letters unscramble to spell the fictional lovers' names, Pamphilia and Amphilanthus. Roth's romantic bliss was not to last. By the mid-1620s, Herbert abandoned her for other lovers. Around this time, she was working on a sequel to the Urania. The second book, handwritten but never published, sees Pamphilia and Amphilanthus marry other people. It also introduces another character, a knight called Fair Design, the name itself to be mysterious. To Roth, Fair would have been synonymous with beautiful, while design meant creation. Fair Design, then, was the fictionalized version of Roth and Herbert's son, William. The story's secret, hinted at but it's never revealed, is that Amphilius is Fair Design's father, and that Amphilanthus's failure to own up to his paternity is why the boy lacks a real traditional name. So, too, did William lack the validation his mother longed to see, and since 17th century England, being fatherless was as good as having no identity at all. The monogram book staring saucily back at me from a black glass bookcase that day in Battersea could not have been a gift from Roth to Herbert. It was published in 1632, 2 years after his death. I think Roth intended to give her son this book, stamped with its elaborate cipher, the intertwined initials of his fictionalized mother and father. Although Roth camouflaged her scandalous sex life in a coded symbol, others may have known of her hopes and dashed dreams. William's paternity was probably an open secret. Roth and Herbert's family certainly knew about it, and so in all likelihood did William. The symbol's meaning would have been legible to a small social circle, according to Joseph Black, a University of Massachusetts historian specializing in Renaissance literature. Ciphers or monograms are mysterious. They draw the eye to ostentatious public assertions of identity, yet at the same time they are puzzling, fully interpretable often to only those few in the know. In the end, the cipher and its hidden meanings outlived its reference. William died fighting for the royalist cause in the English Civil War in the 1640s. Roth is not known to have written another word after Herbert's death. She withdrew from court life and died in 1651 at the age of 63. Sometime thereafter, daughter Catherine probably gathered up the keepsakes from her mother's house before it burned. They included the manuscript of the Urania sequel and William's copy of Cyropaedia, which survived to haunt the present and captivate a book detective one day in Battersea. As a student, I lacked the means to buy Roth's orphan book, but I told a Harvard curator exactly where he could find it. Today, Lady Roth's Cyropaedia is shelved in the university's Hot and Rare Books Library. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. You hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.